Those of you who came to Sprinkles with us that Thursday of VBS, we got a big shout out on Facebook. People still use Facebook. I don't know if you knew that. We got this shout out post from the Sprinkles people. Those of you who remember, we took a picture. They posted the picture and they said this. For anyone who thinks America's youth is in trouble, they've never met the Open Door Teens. A great group of kids to be proud of, Sprinkles would like to thank them for stopping by to make their end of summer celebration complete. Which is the nicest post we've ever gotten from someone who doesn't go to Open Door. So I'm going to print this out. I'm going to hang it in my office. And if you think I'm joking, you're crazy. Say that again.
We're famous.
Yeah. We are famous in the town of Chilai. So that's all fun. That's all cool and that's all fun. For those of you who are here Wednesday, Jess, we could start recording. I don't know if you already did. Oh. For those of you who were here on Wednesday, we talked briefly about a verse in Titus that says this: to the pure, all things are pure, but to the defiled, all things are corrupt. What did we talk about that verse meaning? What does that verse mean? To the pure, all things are pure. Who remembers? Anybody? Sage and Caleb were here and they were leading the discussion really, but they're not here this morning. So someone else got to pick up the slack. Jess, what does it mean?
Guess.
Yeah, take a guess. You weren't here on Wednesday, but take a guess. It is a lot like optimism, but it's more spiritual, but you're close. When you are renewed on the inside, when the Spirit of the Lord has changed you from the inside, then when corruption comes from the outside, it really can't touch you. It really can't hurt you. It really can't corrupt you because you have been internally purified by a force that is stronger than anything outside, right? And so we talk about this of like when you look at a corrupt world around you, when you look at a world that is full of corruption and chaos, there is a way for us to live in that corrupt world without ourselves becoming corrupt, right? Because that corruption cannot defile genuine internal purity through Christ, right? So that was what we talked about on Wednesday. And I told you that for this school year, I want to talk a lot about principles like this, right? It's huge for you guys to learn doctrine about our God, and that's something that's important to me. But I think the next step for most of you is to pursue that kind of wisdom and insight, and I think a lot of you are mature enough to do that. Think of it this way, right? When you go into the kitchen and there is a pan on the stove and the stove is on, do you think, even for a moment, I should touch that? No, you don't. You don't. Because you're all wise enough just by living life. You're all wise enough where nobody has to tell you, hey, don't touch that. Because you just already know. You're already wise enough. So you don't need a sign. You don't need a warning from above. You don't need someone to tell you, hey, don't touch hot pans on stoves. Because you're already mature enough to know that, right? You're wise enough to not need a sign to tell you what to do. And I think a lot of you are smart enough to move in that direction spiritually, where you don't need a verse presently on mind to tell you not to lie, because you're already wise enough to know I should be honest in this moment, right? You're already wise enough to know I should be more forgiving and more quick to forgive than to hold a grudge, right? Like, we have this wisdom sort of trending in that direction, and my goal this year specifically is for you guys to really tap into that internal wisdom that you already have from years of learning the Bible, to tap into that so that I don't have to, you know, give you a fish every Sunday. I can instead tell you, let's go fishing together and catch your own fish, right? You tracking with that? So let's talk about thinking today. Let's talk about thinking. On a scale of 1 to 10, how much control do you think the average person has over what they're thinking? Does that make sense? Like, some thoughts just, like, appear, right? Sometimes you're just thinking, right? And some, like, something just comes. But other times you can, like, consciously decide to think about stuff. So on a scale of 1 to 10, how much control over that do you think the average person has? Mikey's saying 2, Daniel's saying 4, either that or he's just holding up the VBS 4, I can't tell. Daniel's saying 4, Mikey's saying 2, Jesse's saying 10. I disagree with that. Race is saying 6. I think 6 is about where I landed on that. 5 or 6. I think there's a level of control that the average person has of like, I can decide to think about this, but there's other things that just appear that we can't control, right? We would agree with this. It's definitely not 10. Nobody has total perfect control over the mind. Ephesians 4 talks about this. Paul talks about being renewed, not just in your mind. And this is interesting. He says not to be renewed in your mind, but to be renewed in the spirit of your mind. That's different. Okay, to be renewed in the spirit of your mind is almost as if there's like an overarching being that is over your mind. And it's not like you're trying to take control of the car. You're trying to take control of the person driving the car. That's what Paul is kind of saying there, right? You're to renew the spirit of your mind. You're not trying to just renew your mind. You're trying to renew your mind's coach, like their head coach, right? That there's like a general manager over your mind. And that's what we're trying to really renew, not necessarily just your mind, but the thing that controls your mind, the spirit of your mind. It's interesting, right? The Bible talks about thinking in all these kind of ways, and we don't necessarily talk enough about it, in my opinion. Here I am being the guy who's supposed to be talking about it, and I'm saying we don't talk about it enough. But it's not, so Paul's saying it's not just like the car, but you're supposed to renew the guy who's driving the car. It's not just the ship, but the one who's behind the wheel, the captain. In the eyes of the world, your mind is the most important asset that you have, right? Every app, every media outlet, every Netflix show, every game is competing with one another for your attention. It's trying to get you to pay attention to stuff, right? And the longer you can spend watching Netflix, the more money Netflix gets because they've kept your attention for this long, right? This makes sense. So your mind is very valuable to these things. They're all competing to earn your attention and cause you to commit your mind in some way of them. So it would stand to reason that a major part of our sanctification, a major part of our spiritual growth and our spiritual maturity is the renewal of your mind into something that is honoring to God and life-giving. All right, it would stand to reason that, like, the closer I get to the Lord, the more my mind will change on certain things. Does this make sense? We tracking? We got some glazed over eyes this morning. I've had coffee. Clearly you have not, right? Changing the way that our, like, the gears in our mind are turning seems to be an important part of our sanctification, right? It's something I want to talk about this month. Just talking about your mind in August. So here's our outlook today. I want to come away where each of you can believe that the Spirit empowers you. The Spirit gives you the tools necessary to overcome and control your most valuable asset, your mind. So let's pray and then let's look at 2 Corinthians chapter 10. Lord, I pray this morning we would be able to glorify you with the way that we think, that we would learn to honor you with our minds, and Lord, that as we look into the Word, you would continue your work to make us what we are not yet, and it's in your precious name we pray, amen. So, let's get a little more of this in me. We're sponsored by Jitters this morning. Let's read 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 3 through 5. Now, we know there's this verse in Ephesians. There's a series of verses in Ephesians that talk about the armor of God. You familiar with this? The armor of God. You got the sword of the Spirit. You got the helmet of truth, right? You got all these pieces of armor. Paul's talking about these pieces of armor because we are in a war with spiritual forces. There are spiritual forces out in the world that are trying to cause us to stumble, that are trying to cause us to fall flat on our face, and that the only way to overcome these spiritual forces that are trying to come at us is to fight them by the Spirit, to fight them with the sword of the Spirit. Right? The sword is a weapon. The Spirit is a weapon. Paul talks about this spiritual warfare that we go through. He talks about it here in 2 Corinthians chapter 10. Here's verse 3. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not wage war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal. They're not physical. They're not of flesh and blood. But are instead mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments, and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. Because let's talk about thinking. Right, let's talk about your brain. Nobody talks to you as much as you talk to you in your mind, right? You got like a running monologue in your mind at all times, right? You're always thinking. You're always thinking about stuff. Right? You're thinking about that thing that someone did to you that rubbed you the wrong way and you're mad about it. Or you're thinking about like, oh, what am I going to eat later, right? You're always thinking about something. So let's lab this out. Because you don't realize how often you're thinking. Let's lab this out. Something annoying happens to you. Okay, so you're at Jitters. You're at Jitters and you're walking. You got your drink. You got your drink and then you got your drink for your wife. And you're walking out. And someone comes into the door, the push door, and knocks your drinks onto you. That's a bad time. That's real lame. Now it didn't happen to me today. Praise the Lord. Didn't happen to me today. Maybe you're teaching a lesson on a Sunday morning in front of the teens of Open Door. And as you drink your coffee, you suddenly cough at the same time. And a latte comes out of your nose in front of everybody. Maybe that happens, theoretically, hypothetically, in some imaginary world, right? What goes through your mind in that moment? A lot, right? As the coffee is spilling onto your shirt, your white shirt, and onto your fresh white shoes too. Oh man, it's getting dark. What's going through your mind? A lot. A lot of things are going through your mind at that moment. You're like, man, what? I gotta go home and change. I can't let anybody see me. What am I gonna tell my wife? I just spilled her. She doesn't have a cup of coffee because of this bozo came through the door with reckless abandon. He's in a hurry. Knocked my coffee right over. And then he just walked by me, didn't say nothing. Oh, what a tool. I could give him a piece of my mind. All these things going through your mind, right? Later that same day, you pick up your iPhone, and for whatever reason, it's just like your Face ID is just like not working, right? It's just not working. Now, in context of the rest of the day, that is the last thing you wanted to happen. But any other day, you're just like, oh, this is annoying. I guess I'll just put in my passcode. But because the rest of the day happened the way it did, you're like, I didn't need that. Why doesn't my phone just work? Right? This is normal. You guys are laughing because this is exactly how we would all respond. Right? You just had a bunch of things go the other way, the wrong way for you. And you just want to open your phone. You want to play Geometry Dash. Right? But you pick it up. And maybe you got something, you know, on your cheek, got a little stain. And now your Face ID isn't working. That's a first world problem. But guess what? In context of the rest of the day, you are reeling. You're going through it. You're having a terrible time. It makes you even more mad. We're proving a lot of things in this illustration. One, you do not realize how much you think and how much it affects you. You have no idea how much these small things will affect you, right? The more you're just thinking about it, you're just sitting your whole day thinking about that coffee you spilled, all right? Rather, that coffee that bozo spilled on you. And you're thinking about, man, if only the cashier had just taken like 10 extra seconds to process my order and not give me my coffee, that guy would have come in way before I had, right? And you're going through and you're trying to like rewind time with the time stone, right? You're doing all these sort of, and then you're thinking about, man, if only I had maybe grabbed a drink tray. If I grabbed a drink tray, maybe this whole thing wouldn't have happened because I wouldn't have been holding the cups in my hands and instead I would have been able to, you know, shield. And you're thinking about everything and you're just stewing on that one moment. None of you agree? This is just something I do. Right? Oh, this is something we do. This is something we do. Right? And then you're thinking about, man, How come my Face ID isn't working? I could have, what, is there a smudge on my camera? Is there something wrong with my phone? Is Tim Cook trying to get me to get a new iPhone? It's time for my update. Gotta yell at my parents and say I gotta get the new iPhone 13 Plus. Right? You're going through all these things. You don't realize how much you're thinking. You don't realize how much it's affecting you. That's the first thing. The second thing is your mind has its own power, unbeknownst to you, in real time, to inflate or deflate conflicts and annoyances just like willy-nilly. Right? Your mind, in the moment of you picking up your phone and your Face ID not working, it is inflating that problem out of nowhere because you were already mad. Right? Like, your mind has its own spirit of, I have chosen to be mad, therefore anything that happens to me, regardless of what it is from this point forward, is just going to make me furious. Right? It has the spirit of your mind has the power to inflate something that was otherwise innocuous, that was otherwise not going to bother you. And three, if the devil wanted to ruin your day, he only has to do like two things. That's the other thing. Let me tell you a story. The Tuesday before flyering, July 15th, probably it was, July 14th, we went flyering the first time that Wednesday. I'm going to Wegmans. Bree and I are going to make a chicken pot pie for dinner. And we got to get some ingredients. So I go to Wegmans. I got the shopping list. I got the recipe up on my phone. And as I'm pulling into Wegmans, I'm like, let me get a little sneak peek before I walk into Wegmans. Let me get ahead of the curve. And I'm driving while I'm doing this. I don't recommend this at all. And you'll see why in a moment. So as I'm pulling into, you know, the Chile Wegmans, it's got the little downhill thing and it swerves a little bit, swirls. I'm going from Aldi straight across over to Wegmans in a little curvy-do, and I miss the curvy-do completely. And I rock the curb with my front right tire. I just crush the curb. If you look on the curb, you can actually see where I hit it. Still, yeah, I left a mark on the curb. And it pops my tire, it bends my tire out of alignment, and now I'm pulling into the little back lot of Target with three tires on my car, and I gotta jack my car up, and I gotta take the tire off, and I gotta put my spare on. It's a nightmare. That's a bad day for anybody. That's just like a run-of-the-mill bad day. That's just like your textbook bad day. You look up bad day in the dictionary, and it's like, yeah, when you run over a curb and you pop your tire, right? From there, I realize that my tire is out of alignment, because with my spare tire now on my car, I can only go about 12 miles an hour in my car. I'm driving, I've got like 9 lights just came up on my dashboard. Your tire pressure's off, your alignment's off, your power steering is messed up, all sorts of lights coming on. And I'm leaving a skid mark on Paul Road all the way from Target to our apartment. There was a point in time where if you had caught it fresh, you would find a skid mark that would lead straight to the driveway of our apartment. Now, luckily, Bree was off of work this day for reasons that are a total different story. She's off work this day, so she's able to follow me in my car with her hazards on. Her dad was able to come and help me take my tire off my car. But from there, I'm like, okay, well, it's a Tuesday. Tomorrow, we're doing something we've never done before. We're going flyering. So now, I got to figure out how I'm going to do work from home. I got to figure out how I'm going to print out enough flyers for us to be able to use. I got to do all these sorts of things. I can't go into church to do it. And I'm thinking about all these different things. And everything's starting to pile up. And then suddenly, it's Wednesday, and I get a call. We're going to use the church van, okay? We're going to use the church van for flyering. I get a call from Paul St. Denis that day, hey, I got COVID. I was driving the van all day. And I'm like, well, now I can't use the van. And now I'm reeling. And all these different things happen. There was like all sorts of other things, but I'm running out of time, so I can't even tell you all. In the 24 hours leading up to when we left for flyering, like 90 things happened that were all frustrating, sure. But with everything that came after me popping my tire on a curb, with everything that came after, I was almost willfully giving Satan more footholds to break into my mind. I'm just like stewing and I'm letting myself get so mad about all this. I'm like way outside of prayer, right? At this point, I'm just like so frustrated. I'm not even thinking about praying. I'm just so mad, right? And all of these subsequent things that happen that pile on top of me popping my tire on a curb because I'm dumb, right? All these things that are happening, I'm just giving Satan footholds. I'm giving him footholds. I'm giving him footholds. I'm letting him build houses. He's got real estate. Right? Because, like, doesn't it all seem, like, almost too, like, perfect? Right? The timing, the specific ways that it hindered my plans, right? Satan was, like, setting the any percent speed run of ruining my day. And I was letting him kill it. I was letting him crush it. When Paul says here, casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. This goes way beyond just be positive. Right? Be positive. People are telling you, hey, just be positive. Think positive. And that's like cool, sure, but like, how, right? Like they're saying, the advice that we see is like, be positive, because positive is good. Being positive is a good thing. You know, when bad things happen, just be positive about them and they won't be bad anymore, right? Don't ask me how to do it. Just, you know, be positive. This is substantially different because 2 Corinthians 5 or 10:5 is actually not telling you to be positive. It's not telling you to just like, be happy about stuff, kid. You know, it's not telling you that. Instead, what it's saying is take your thoughts captive. Paul knows just as much as any of us that there can be an errant thought that comes into your mind, or something bad can happen and you can have a reaction to it that is bad. And you can start thinking about things that have just happened to you in a way that is negative and hindering. Paul is not saying, hey, just be positive about it. He's saying, when errant thoughts come in and creep into your mind and tear you down, arrest them and take them to jail. That's what he's saying. Take these thoughts captive for the obedience of Christ. He is not saying, train your mind to not think this way. He's not saying, if you're just like positive enough for long enough, then you won't think bad things. He's not saying that because it's a lie. It's not true. It won't happen. Instead, he is saying, when an errant thought comes into your mind to corrupt you, to take what is otherwise pure and trample it. He's not saying that that's a sin. He's saying that if you linger on it, that's probably not as good. And you should arrest that thought and send it to mind jail. It's not telling you not to think negative thoughts or destructive thoughts. Paul isn't dumb. He knows, probably better than us, just how quickly toxic thoughts can enter our mind. People try to kill Paul all the time. He talks about it later in this book. He's like, yeah, so there was a bunch of times I was like shipwrecked, and there was a bunch of times where people were throwing rocks at me, and there was a bunch of times that people were trying to, you know, arrest me and throw me in jail, and there was a couple times I ended up in jail, and there was a bunch. Like, Paul definitely knows what it's like to, like, be down bad and be like reeling. Yeah? This is not a command to stop like being negative in your brain. It's something else entirely. It is saying that when you think things that are otherwise hindering you or pulling you down or corrupting you, right? Or you had like some kind of like misunderstanding with a person who is otherwise like someone you respect and love. And you have a misunderstanding and suddenly you're like, oh man, they said something and I don't really, like I wasn't like used to that tone. Do they hate me now? Right? Paul is saying, hey, cling to what you actually know. Cling to what you know for sure. And when that thought comes into your mind, take it captive and compare it to the things that you know to be true for sure. guess what? Your mom doesn't hate you. Right? Like, your best friend doesn't hate you because you accidentally, like, you, like, snapped at them for, like, you were having, like, a bad day and you accidentally, like, snapped at them. They don't hate you. They maybe just didn't love how you talked to them in that moment, but you have this, like, history of being friends. Right? Cling to what you know for the obedience of Christ. And this, like, goes so much further, like, with our fellowship, with our sanctification. Right? Like, something else entirely than just be positive. The second thing is, like, this power comes not from your desire to be positive, but it comes from the power of God to destroy strongholds. Strongholds are something that we talked about when you remember when we talked about thou shalt not covet for, like, 3 weeks? Remember that? A stronghold is, like, a pattern of thinking that you have so thoroughly adopted that it now, like, colors the rest of the things you think about. I compared it to, like, my whole life I really bought into, like, what's called sibling theory, sibling order theory, where, like, all youngest siblings are one way and all oldest siblings are one way and all middle siblings are one way. Because it's, like, very true for, like, the way that it's described and the things that I've read, it's very, like, applicable to my siblings. And so I'm like, oh, this is just true for everybody. And I'm just this way. And, like, the things that it says about me, I believe are now true. But, like, that doesn't get to tell me who I am. Right? And so that's a stronghold that, like, the Lord has the power to destroy. That the Lord has the power to break down in my mind that, like, hey, you don't have to think of things in terms of you always want to be at the center of stuff. Right? You don't have to now, like, you know, like, this is what it says about youngest siblings, right? It's like, you always want to be in the center of attention, right? And it's like, maybe the Lord has, like, gifted me in ways that put me on, you know, stage to do an Australian accent for a bunch of seven-year-olds, right? But that doesn't mean that I now have to, you know, I'm now interrogating myself because I'm a youngest sibling. And, like, no. The Lord has gifted me in a way that I want to use. You see how that's, like, breaking down that stronghold to remove from me, like, self-doubt for the things that the Lord has clearly called me to do? Breaking down strongholds for the obedience of Christ. Pessimism, pettiness, rage, like, you're just always mad about stuff. Those are strongholds. Those are strongholds. These are spiritual wars that we wage in our minds. I would say it's pretty uncommon for you to meet a real human person. Not internet. Internet people don't count. For you to meet a real human person who actively tries to corrupt, crush down, or even, like, sincerely argue against your faith in Jesus. In my experience, that's very rare. For someone to actually be, like, committed to, like, you're a Christian, that's a bunch of baloney, I'm gonna argue you out of it. That's so rare. Like, those people don't, like, there's not a lot of them. We like to think that there's a lot of them because, you know, there's this, like, anxiety about it that we have to be so smart. But really, people, like, they're not that serious about it. In my experience, the hubbub about people being, like, anti-Christian in real life is just noise, because in reality, people don't care as much as you think they will. And that's really the problem that we have to face, right? That people don't care, right? For every one real-life person that you meet in your life that actively tries to argue you out of your faith, for every one of those people you meet, you will encounter 10,000 destructive, corrupting thoughts and ideas. Right? For every one person you meet, there's going to be thousands upon thousands of thoughts that creep into your mind. The war that we wage spiritually is not with people, individuals. It is with spiritual forces that creep into your mind and try to corrupt you from your inside. Spiritual warfare is constantly in play in our mind. I could teach all day, I could teach all year about what you should say when you enter a conversation with an atheist. We could go through that for a year. But it will do nothing for you when they ask you a question you can't answer. Because there will always be a question you can't answer. Because you're talking about the anthropological evidence for creation. You're talking about the anthropological evidence that exists in the Middle East and how they're finding aquatic fossils at the top of a mountain. How could this be possible if not for a worldwide flood that brought sea creatures up to the tops of mountains? How could it be possible, my atheist friend, for all human history to all coalesce into one singular area? How could that be so possible? Right? And you're talking about all the anthropological evidence, and suddenly they point you to Exodus, where it says, hey, if your God never changes, how come in Exodus it says he changes his mind? And you go, wait, what? Wait, what do you mean? That wasn't what we were talking about. Let's go to the thing I know how to talk about. And you say, I don't know. You say, I don't know, let me get back to you. And you linger on it for weeks. You linger on this question of why does Exodus say this? Why does it say that God changed? Why does it say Moses went up to the mountain and asked God to change his mind, and then he did it? Like God never changes, right? And you realize in that moment you don't have any tools whatsoever to approach a thought that is in your mind and is corrupting you, and is wearing you down, and is eating you alive. You have no tools whatsoever to deal with it. You realize suddenly. You're afraid to ask someone. What if they don't know either? Or what if they think that me asking this is like a negative, you know, me asking this at all makes me seem like a weak Christian? Like, I don't want to seem like that to somebody. Like, I don't want to ask what. You're reeling. You're going through it. It never occurs to you to think of the linguistic, vocabularic shortcomings of translating from Hebrew into English. Never occurs to you. Never occurs to you that God changes his mind all the time by showing mercy to people who deserve punishment. Or it never occurs to you that God makes tons of conditional promises to the Israelites, and that when they don't follow through on their end of the bargain, God says, okay, well, you're not going to get this thing that I promised you conditionally. Never goes through your mind to think about these things. Never goes through your mind. None of this occurs to you because you're 14 and nobody ever prepared you to deal with a thought gone haywire like this. There's nothing sinful about that doubt. Over and over and over in the Bible, we see faithful people who deal with doubt. The book of Habakkuk is all about a guy who's like doubting. He's like, God, I don't know why you're doing the thing you're doing. And God says, okay, I'll try to explain it to you. Here, the Israelites are corrupt people, and so I'm going to send Babylon to crush them down. And Habakkuk says, wait, but that's not good either. Like, we like Israel. Israel's certainly better. It's bad, but it's better than Babylon, right? And God says, well, yeah, sure, but the people of Israel kind of need this punishment. They've fallen short of the conditional promises that I made to them. And so this is the proper action that has to follow their actions, right? And so you can ask me these questions, or I can promise you that someday in the future there's going to be a hope and a promise and a redemption revealed to the people of God. And all you have to do in order to find it and experience it is to live by faith on your own. And Habakkuk says, all right. When the olive tree falls short, and when the stables are empty, and when the crops fail, I will trust on the Lord my God, who makes my feet stable on the rock like the deer. That's all I can hope for. There's all sorts of people who deal with doubt. Jeremiah in the book of Lamentations says, God, you are wicked and you are crushing me down. He says, if I turn to Lamentations, it's going to turn into 15 minutes, but it's... Jeremiah is mad at God for what he allowed to happen in Jerusalem. He's furious at God. He's saying these things. I cannot believe you did this. But yet, great is your faithfulness. Your mercies are new every morning. So like this doubt is not bad. This doubt to like question, like, I don't get this stuff. I don't understand it. It doesn't make any sense to me. That's not sin. It's a shortage of information. Guess what? When we're talking about the eternal God of all creation, there's going to be a shortage of information on your end. The book of Job says we only know the corner of his ways. That there's this giant garment, there's this giant tapestry of everything that God has ever done. And all we see is the little tassel on the corner. That's all we see of all of what God is and all of creation. We know so little about the eternal magnitude of God. You're going to have a shortage of information. You're going to have questions that like other people can't answer. It's going to happen. That's not sin. For you to linger on that thought and not take it captive to the obedience of Christ will crush you. That story of the atheist who asks, how come God changes his mind? That happened to me. That's my story. That's a story that happened in my real life that sent me reeling from 14 to 17. And I never asked anybody about it because 1 Peter says you should always be ready to give an account for your God. You should always be ready to give an answer. And I was like, well, I should be, but I'm not. But I can't tell anybody that I'm not. It's my story. You cannot do anything to never have a doubt again. There's no amount of sanctification you'll reach where you're like, okay, done doubting. It's not going to happen. That is impossible. You will never get to a point of sanctification where you no longer have an errant thought. You'll never get a point where you hear something corrupt and for a second you don't go, that kind of makes sense though. You're never going to get to that point. But these things will create a wildfire in you if you do not trust that the Spirit gives you the tools and gives you the power to contain and take captive errant, corrupting thoughts. Whether it's with your fellowship with your friends, whether it is with your communion with God, whether it is with, fill in the blank. I mean, we go through so much. People are trying to get your attention every day, all day, for everything. There's never a moment where people aren't vying for your attention. We're constantly dealing with wars in our mind. So what do? How do you take thoughts captive? Well, I encourage you to ask people, you know. We have a lot of really solid leaders in here that would be happy to bounce questions back and forth. That story about the atheist is literally my life experience story. If you deal with something like that, believe me, I too have been in that situation, right? Talk to us. Something else you can do, cling to what you know. There is a quote from Charles Spurgeon, one of my favorite theologians, preachers and writers. He says, when the waves cast me ashore, I will cling to the rock of ages. Because he writes like a poet. And he's saying, when things sweep me off my feet, I will cling to what I know, the rock of ages, cleft for me. Let me hide my strength in thee. Something else you can do. Don't be shy toward God about your struggles. We love to think that, like, if we pretend long enough to, like, have it figured out, that, like, we can fake it and then someday make it, right? And that, like, if I just try hard enough, no one will notice. Maybe even God. That doesn't work. If you don't make known to God the fact that you are struggling, guess what? You're going to keep struggling. You're going to keep struggling because you're not asking for help. God will grab you and he will pull you out from the mud from time to time. But usually, I would say 99 out of 100 times, God is going to first wait for you to willfully put your hand up to ask for help. There will be times where he will just yank you out, sure. But that's not the norm. And if that happens, it means you sank so far that your hand wasn't going to work anymore. Ask God for help, and he will freely give it to you. We talked about it in James. Ask God for wisdom, and he will give liberally. He will give generously. This sort of stuff, we got to ask God for help. And we have to sincerely believe that the Spirit gives you the power to overcome and control your most valuable asset, your mind. Let's pray. Lord, I pray that as we look forward to this next school year, as we look forward to what lies ahead for the rest of 2022, I pray that you would give us power over our minds. That you would encourage us and teach us to somehow, some way, to take captive thoughts that enter in and to seek internal purification, to seek edification of ourselves, to take captive thoughts that don't serve us, and to cling to what we know to be true. To cling to what we know pushes us toward the obedience of Christ.
Help us with our relationships. Help us with our sanctification. Help us with our friendships and with our devotion to you. Lord, all of these things purify our minds and help us to cling to what we know. Help us to be faithful. Help us to be faithful with our minds. And make us what we are not yet. And so all these things we pray in your precious name. Amen.